If you're the kind of person that believes that there is a mythical being who lives at the North Pole making toys all year round, and then on one night of the year comes and delivers them to everyone all over the world at the same time, then you might need to ask the person next to you to put their fingers in your ears at certain points. Well, I'm going to assume perhaps that you're all a bit too grown up for that. So I'm going to take the risk that this might disillusion a few of you, but we'll cope, won't we? Now, perhaps you've heard this before. It was there's an email I remember a number of years back that I just because I have a twisted sense of humour, it used to really, really amuse me. I don't know whether it's just something you've heard before, but this is a guy sort of from a scientific point of view, maybe a bored scientist, doing an analysis of Santa Claus. Listen to this. I don't know if you've heard it before. He says, is there really a Santa? Well, let's consider the facts. No known species of reindeer can fly. But with 300,000 species of living organisms, mostly insects and bacteria, yet to be classified, flying reindeer, which only Santa has seen, cannot be ruled out. There are 2 billion children in the world, give or take. But since Santa doesn't appear to handle Muslim, Hindu, Buddhist and Jewish children, his workload drops to about 378 million, or a mere 91.8 million homes, if you average 3.5 children each, assuming that at least one has been good. Thanks to time zones and the rotation of the Earth, Santa's Christmas Day lasts for 31 hours, if he travels east to west, and if he visits 822.6 homes per second. This gives him 1/1000th of a second to park, race down the chimney, fill the stockings, distribute the remaining gifts under the tree, eat the snacks, climb up the chimney and into the sleigh and fly to the next house. Assuming the houses are all at the same distance apart, about 0.78 miles, the total trip will be 75.5 million miles, plus bathroom stops. So our jolly old friend is travelling at 650 miles per second, or 3,000 times the speed of sound. For comparison, the fastest man-made vehicle, the Ulysses space probe, saunters along at a pokey 27.4 miles per second. And the average reindeer runs at 15 miles per hour. The sleigh's payload adds another factor to the equation. Assuming that each child's gift weighs only about 2 pounds, which is reasonable, the sleigh is carrying 321,300 tons, plus Santa, who's always depicted as obese. On land, conventional reindeer can only haul about 300 pounds. So if a flying reindeer can pull, let's say, 10 times as much, 8 or 9 will not cope. We now need 214,000 of them, which adds another 353,430 tons to the weight. Here's where it gets juicy, literally. 675,000 tons travelling at 650 miles per second creates massive air resistance, like that of a space probe re-entering the atmosphere. Rudolph, who leads the pack, will face friction that generates 14.3 quintillion joules of energy per second. In fact, he will explode instantaneously, exposing the next reindeer to the same experience. These explosions will cause deafening sonic booms as the whole team is vaporized in less than 0.005 of a second. Santa will also experience 17,500 G-forces, which will pin him to his seat with 4,315,000 pounds of pressure. This will unavoidably mean that the maiden flight of Santa's sleigh will also be his last. Yes, there was a Santa, but now he's dead. Funny stuff. Well, I don't know how you were brought up with regards to Christmas. Most families have their own traditions. My dad's Dutch, so Christmas was a big deal for him, but it was always St. Nicholas Day that he got the most excited about. So we celebrated it on the 6th of December, and we used to leave our wellies outside the front door with a carrot or something in it for St. Nicholas's donkey. And we do that on the evening of the 5th. I don't know if any of you follow this particular tradition, probably not. And then we would race down in the morning and open the front door to see what was in our wellies, and it would be loaded full of chocolates, wellies full of chocolates, fantastic. And then throughout the day, my dad would periodically come into rooms where we were playing with our toys, and he'd sort of just, a hand would come through the door and he'd throw sweets into the room. My dad loved St. Nicholas. He loved Christmas. It was great fun being in our house. But we also had other kind of traditions for how we did Christmas Day itself. For us, it was usually this kind of a late breakfast. You know, you have a bit of a line, you have a late breakfast, and then you might start opening the presents about 11 o'clock, and then a late lunch, then sit in front of the telly, Queen's speech, movies, and you can't be bothered to get off the sofa because you're just so full of food and you're eating chocolates. And it's a lovely, lazy Christmas. My wife, on the other hand, though, you know, I've had to do lots of Christmases at her home, and they are hardcore Christmas people. They get up at 5 o'clock in the morning when the first sort of person wakes. Everyone has to come down. And you have to sit around the tree, opening presents till almost midday, one at a time while everybody watches. This mountain of presents. It's deadening. And you maybe make a little sort of stop to go to the toilet or something, or to have a slice of toast or some coffee. But it is absolutely exhausting. And you kind of feel like a zombie by the end of the day. I like my family tradition better. I do, I have to say. Some traditions are better than other traditions, aren't they? Some of them just, you know, some appeal more. But after all, Christmas is all about traditions. And I was thinking to myself, you know, where do some of these traditions come from? Where does the whole Santa thing come from? You know, why is it that people bring a tree into their house? Well, it's got to be tradition. There's no rational reason for doing that. Why do we dress a fat bloke up in red and sit children on his knee and give them gifts? It's got to be tradition. That's just weird. And that set me off thinking, you know, especially the Christmas tree. How did that start? I mean, it's got to be a bloke, hasn't it? You know, bringing a tree. It's got to be a bloke, did it? And I wonder whether he sort of was looking for flowers for his missus or something. And he couldn't find any flowers. And he used bloke logic at this point. I thought, well, flowers. Flowers are pretty. Trees are pretty. Flowers are living. Trees are living. Where's my axe? Sort of thing. And for some reason it caught on because his wife liked the sparkly twinkly bits that he put on the tree. And we ended up with Christmas tree. I don't know if that's how it happened, but that sounds plausible to me. So I thought I'd try and sort out the facts from the fiction about Santa Claus with you this morning, just a little bit, to find out where the traditions come from. Now I'm at an advantage because I was brought up with the whole tradition of St. Nicholas in my home. And I was told these stories when I was young. There was a real Santa Claus. I mean, that's what the name became, from St. Nicholas. It got kind of muddled and translated into lots of different languages. It ended up as kind of Santa Claus. And he was born sometime around the end of the 3rd century, and he was Greek, but he worked as a bishop in Turkey, in a small town in Turkey. And let me have a look. Here we go. This is about the earliest picture I could find of him, looking a little bit suspicious there. And he's doing that thing that bishops do with his fingers, yeah, with a sort of, could I say something, please? Sort of look on his face. There's a lot of myths and legends about him, but this is what I think we can say with any degree of certainty. He lived. That's pretty certain because he's remembered and there are sort of records of him living and being the bishop. And I think also that he did good deeds. He was a good sort of a good bloke. People thought he was a good bloke. Because they don't normally turn you into a saint if you don't. Okay, that's just my kind of logic there. So I think he lived and he was a good guy. The rest of it could all just be apocryphal. But according to legend, there's one particular story that I think is very illuminating with St. Nicholas. Now, the story goes that in his town was a very poor family. And maybe some of you know this story. There was a father who had 3 daughters, and I think he was widowed. And the 3 daughters, they were so poor that none of the 3 daughters could get married because they couldn't afford a dowry. And it looked like their fate was going to be they'd have to be sold into prostitution. St. Nicholas just didn't want this to happen. But St. Nicholas was also known for trying to do his good in secret. He wanted to give things secretly. So he came along one night with a bag of money for a dowry for one of the girls, and he lobbed it through a window. I assume the window was open. He lobbed it through the window. So in the morning, they found this bag of money that could pay the dowry for this girl. About a month or so later, after this girl had got married, St. Nicholas thought, I'll do it again. So he lobs another bag of money in through the window. and the second daughter can get married. Now, the father's catching on at this point and thinking, I'd really like to know who it is that's giving gifts for my daughters to get married. So he lay in wait by the window. But St. Nicholas got wind of this, so he climbed onto the roof. And he took his bag of money and he dropped it down the chimney. You see, it's all sort of starting to come together now, isn't it? What's more, that third daughter just happened to be drying her stockings in the fireplace that night, as the story goes, and the bag of gold fell into her stocking. So in the morning she woke up and there was prezzies in her stocking. This is apparently how the legend goes. What a wonderful surprise to find. And I guess, we get our traditions from that story. Fact or fiction, I don't know. Maybe a bit of both. But at least if someone asks you, do you believe in Santa Claus, you can say yes. Yeah, I do, actually. He died about 1,700 years ago. But I do believe that Santa Claus existed. You know, isn't education wonderful? I love listening to things like this, you know, Radio 4 sort of stuff. I don't know about you. Just for a little bit of light entertainment before we go on to now look at Jesus and some of the myths about Jesus, check out this little video.
Ah, Christmas. The time of year we celebrate the birth of Santa. Oh, I mean Jesus. Oh, oops, sorry about that. Those two have so much in common, I'm afraid I often get them confused. I mean, we usually think of them as both having beards and being surrounded by happy little children scurrying about. They both have quite an uncommon last name that starts with C. And what's with all the nicknames? They both have a ton of nicknames like Father Christmas, Prince of Peace, Saint Nicholas, Emmanuel, and so on. Speaking of names, does anybody else find it odd that they both somehow know everyone's name? And not just that. I hear they both like to keep detailed records on all of us. But they both seem like pretty generous guys, which is probably why we flood both of them with wish lists and then desperately hope they come through for us. The more I think of it, I guess there are a few important differences. For example, I don't think Jesus was known for wearing velvet, but Santa seems to be obsessed with it. Plus, no one has ever accused Jesus of breaking in through the chimney and eating all the cookies. In the end, I keep going back to Santa's naughty or nice distinction. If we're being totally honest, we'll probably find ourselves hoping Santa isn't too strict, or at least we hope he's grading on a curve. Jesus, on the other hand, came because none of us are nice enough. Of course, we keep trying to convince others and ourselves otherwise. Ultimately, Santa is about me and the stuff I so desperately want. But Jesus is about something more, the grace I so desperately need. Come to think of it, maybe they don't have that much in common after all.
Yes, quite thought-provoking, isn't it? Well, we've given jolly old Saint Nick a bit of the Mythbusters treatment. It's only fair that we try and do that with Jesus as well. Now, it always amazes me how little people really know about Jesus when you meet them. I was at Freshers' Fair at Kingston University a couple of months back, and just talking to people. I talked to loads of people throughout the day, and I asked them all specifically one question, generally, which was, have you ever investigated Jesus for yourself? You know, not what other people have said and what you've heard, but have you ever done it for yourself? Have you ever even read, perhaps, a gospel, one of the life accounts of Jesus in the Bible? You ever done that? And the answer, almost consistently, was no, never done it. And I asked myself, you know, why not? I think that's a bit odd. Why wouldn't someone who considers himself to have a well-rounded education actually have read one of those Gospels? Yeah, they are pretty influential. They're full of stories. They're not hard to read. They're so short, a couple of hours, you could read one from beginning to end, one of the short ones, even if you're a slow reader like me. Listen, if you've never done that, I'm happy to give you one at the end of this, so come and see me and get one. Very easy to read. But, I mean, think about it. The Bible is still, by far, the best-selling book that's ever been published. I was looking at this earlier this week. Do you know, there's probably about 10 billion copies of the Bible in the world. That's more than there are people. That is a true bestseller. They don't even put it on the bestseller list because it just wipes the floor with everything else. Jesus is the reason that we live in the year 2011. You know, our calendar started with his birth date. Think about that. And yet people don't want to know anything about this man. He's influenced our legal system. His words and his teachings are quoted all over the place. He's probably the most influential person that's ever lived. Affected history and culture in many, many, many countries. And yet so many people, probably the majority of people, certainly in this country, have never read him. Especially if my survey is anything to go by. We're probably talking about 2% of people have ever read him, of people I met. Truth of the matter is that we probably hear Jesus' name used every day, but it's generally in the place of a swear word. I mean, really, this man who's had all that influence, and that's all he is. Well, here's some myth-busting material to start you off then in, finding out about the real Jesus. There's no substitute for reading one of those Gospels, though, and I recommend you do that. Maybe you can do it over Christmas. But here's the first of the myths I thought we could look at. First myth, Jesus was born on the 25th of December. So I'm sorry, Boney M, but Mary's boy child, Jesus Christ, certainly, almost certainly, was not born on Christmas Day. In fact, nobody really knows when Jesus was born. No one knows the date. The only people that probably knew the date were Mary, Joseph, and some shepherds. And we can't really ask them because they're dead. And the thing is that it's actually quite surprising is there's a lot of debate about this stuff, which I find really, really odd because it's so unimportant. The date, though, the 25th of December, has been held since at least the 4th century. So maybe even St. Nicholas would have known about the date of Christmas being on the 25th of December. And it's on the basis of some pretty spurious mathematics. So originally, the way they calculated it was, there was a guy called John Chrysostom that preached this. And he said that we can date it by knowing the conception date of John the Baptist. Because we're told... he says that was the Day of Atonement. And then we're told that when Elizabeth, Zacharias' wife, was 6 months pregnant, that was when Mary conceived. Yeah? So we can then date it all on, and it works out to 25th of December. The problem is that the date's actually very, very spurious there, because we don't know that John the Baptist was conceived on the Day of Atonement. So it kind of like totally knocks the foundation out of all of that thinking, doesn't it? It's all very neat, but it's, what's the point? What is the point? Most scholars seem to agree, though, that it probably wasn't in the winter. It probably wasn't December. And they based that on the fact that sheep were grazing in the fields and there isn't much for them to graze on in December. But hey, look, this really doesn't matter. And actually, when you come to look at it, Christians might have fallen out over a lot of things in history, but they've never fallen out over the date of Christmas. It's just not a big issue. But it's probably a myth, Jesus born on the 25th of December. I hope that doesn't ruin your Christmas. But that's myth number one. Myth number two is this. I think a lot of people believe this. That Jesus grew up to be a very religious person. Was he? Was Jesus religious? A lot of people assume so, but in reality, especially if you read the eyewitness accounts, what you tend to find is that actually Jesus generally clashed with the religious people. And he spent most of his time hanging out with reprobates. He spent most of his time hanging out with taxmen, prostitutes, people who were the dregs of society. Religious people, he constantly clashed with them. He didn't get on with them. In addition, much of his teaching actually sought to dismantle tradition. Jesus had a really good poke at tradition. See, religion had become hypocrisy in Jesus' day, as much of it is today, isn't it? And some of the most scathing remarks Jesus made were directed at the religious establishment of his day. Jesus sought to bring people then back to the heart of what God actually required of them. And his message wasn't about keeping religious rules, do's and don'ts. It wasn't about that. It was about having a relationship with our Creator. That's what he was talking about. Jesus wasn't religious. I would go so far as to say that Jesus hated the kind of religion that put barriers between people and God, things you must do. So if you don't like religion, and I know a lot of people don't, you're in good company if you're with Jesus. He doesn't like it either. Jesus wasn't religious. In fact, think about it. It was the most religious people of his day that got him nailed to a cross. Jesus wasn't religious. It's a myth. Jesus wasn't religious. The third myth I wanted to quickly look at as we finish up here is that Jesus' death on the cross was to give us an example of love. See, this one's a bit slippery, because like all good myths, there's a bit of truth in it. Jesus' crucifixion did demonstrate his love for the world, make no mistake about that. But not just as an example to copy. Actually, Jesus' death went much, much further. On the cross, a swap took place. The cross was where Jesus actually bore the guilt and the punishment in place of others. That's what the cross is really about. Do you know that? So in a way, yes, the cross is the most extreme picture of love that the world has ever seen. That's true. But the question is, what are you supposed to do with it? Some people have taught that the main point that we're supposed to do, you know, to find, is to look at it and be inspired by Jesus' sacrificial nature. Loving our neighbours, even more than we love ourselves. You know, this going to death because we love people so much. But whilst there's truth in that, it actually misses the main point about the cross. The main point is that God loves us. And he loves us even to the extent of sending his son to die in our place. It's about a sacrifice. It's about a swap. The main point is that Jesus was a perfect, obedient and willing sacrifice who offered to stand between us and the wrath of God that we desire, that we deserve, the punishment from God that we deserve because of our sin. See, the Bible declares that all mankind are enemies of God. Do you know that? Enemies of God. See, we take the good gifts that he gives, and we like those, but we don't even acknowledge him who's given us those gifts. Why? Because we're so caught up in our own lives. And Christmas exemplifies that, doesn't it? So caught up in all of the shiny things that we can get, and all the more. We'd rather give our time and our devotion to gaining more wealth, more fame, more popularity, more education, than to give even a few minutes to our Creator. Isn't that true? But the Bible also says this, and it's wonderful good news. The Bible says this, God demonstrates his own love for us in this, while we were still sinners. So while we're going on doing things like that, ignoring God, putting him out of the, you know, doing things that offend him, while we're like that, that's when Christ died for us. Can you see how the cross is so much more than just an example of love? It is actually love in action, doing something. Something very, very important. So what happened on the cross is the centerpiece of what the Bible is all about. And Christmas is only significant because it's a celebration of the arrival of the King who came to rescue people. It's about rescue. The truth about Jesus, the truth about Christmas, the most important thing, well, Christmas commemorates the start of a rescue mission. Think about that over Christmas. What I'm celebrating is the start of a rescue mission. And it's like the angels said to the shepherds, in a nutshell, that first Christmas Eve. Christmas is all about the birth of a saviour. It's about a coming of a saviour into the world. Well, that's all I'm going to say this morning. I'm going to give you a few minutes now to just chat about some of the things that have been said. It could be about Santa stuff. I'm not the world's authority on Santa. Or it could be stuff about Jesus that you'd like to know more about. Have a little chat, maybe with the person next to you or the people around you, for a couple of minutes, and then we'll take any questions in a second. Okay? And get a drink as well while you're doing it.
We were just talking about stories about Christmas, and whether, in fact, there was a census, whether it was necessary for Joseph and Mary to go to Bethlehem. Mm. When they got to Bethlehem, the chances are that there would have been relatives there who would have looked after them anyway. Mm. That there are two words for inns, that Middle Eastern houses were such that the room that you occupied was very close to where the animals were, yes. So you could quite easily put the baby through a gap in the wall and place it in a manger and things like that. And we were coming to the conclusion that it doesn't really matter. The fact that it's been handed down in a different form doesn't destroy the thrust of it, although it's quite interesting to see what might have happened by studying it more carefully.
Yes. Yeah, I think that what we do, what people do with all of that stuff is they raise all of these little sort of objections. And when you think about them, a lot of these objections that they have are things that happened 2,000 years ago, that actually we can't be certain about any of that. I mean, we don't know whether that's right or whether what the Bible, you know, we can't say anything from just looking at the external evidence, which one's true. But people will raise that today and say, oh, but that puts a big question mark over everything, doesn't it? Because if I can't trust that, then I can't trust anything else. What I would say, though, is probably the best birth narrative, the most detailed birth narrative in the Bible, is by Luke. Luke was an educated man. He was a doctor. He was a very careful historian. And modern-day historians have a lot of respect for him as a historian. Also, he writes his account in a style that throws in a lot of very unnecessary detail. He time and date stamps everything by talking about who's governor, who's emperor, who's doing this, who's the high priest, so that it's as if the readers who wrote at the time when he wrote could look back and say, oh yes, I remember when so-and-so, when Quirinius was governor, and when so-and-so was the high priest. So he writes very much in an academic kind of style like a historian. Very unnecessarily so. He also says at the beginning of his gospel that he's carefully investigated everything and he's written it with the purpose so that you will know and that by knowing you can believe. So he's a very careful historian and his documents are very well respected. So read Luke's account. I think it's probably as good as any other archaeological evidence could possibly throw at it. I think he's probably better because he was actually around at the time. Okay?
Well, just a comment. I was reading this morning from reading from C.S. Lewis about Christmas, and he said it was either the most significant day in history, or it was worthless as a non-event. So, the most significant in the sense that it's the day when the Creator of the universe came to Earth to rescue us, as you said, or it didn't happen at all. I mean, there's sort of kind of two choices, and the world would kind of like to have a middle ground somewhere.
Yeah,
that's a cute baby Jesus in a manger, yes. But no, it's either the most significant event in the history of the planet, or it's nothing.
Well, what we do, though, isn't it right, as a culture, is we like to clean, sanitize, and dress up and make everything cuddly, don't we? When was the last time you saw a Christmas card with a nativity scene where there was like animal poo on the floor? You just don't see it. It's all been clean swept and it's lovely. And the little crib, the little cot, looks more comfortable than a modern day Moses basket, doesn't it? With the lovely straw and the lovely little clean animals all around. It's just we dress up everything and sanitise everything, don't we? Look, the thing I would really recommend if you've never read a gospel is read a gospel and come to your own conclusions. Like I say, they are very good documents historically. Very good. They're the best eyewitness accounts that we've got. If you want to actually come to conclusions about this stuff, you need to read one. And so I highly recommend you do that. Come to your own conclusions about that. Like C.S. Lewis said, if you read a gospel, you've got to make a decision about Jesus. He gives only three options about Jesus. He's either mad, bad, or God. He's either mad because he's saying things that make absolutely no sense because he's saying that he's God. You know, only a mad person would claim to be God if they're not. That also goes for being bad. Only a bad person would say, you need to follow me and do what I say. If you want to go to heaven, you've got to do it my way. You'd be bad if that's not true. Or he's God, the third option. There isn't actually a fourth option. So read a gospel and think that through. It's a very, very good thing to think through. Yeah. And incidentally, I think I do still have some gospels if anyone wants them. In fact, I think I've got some Luke. No, I haven't.
Andy, I was quite taken with your comment about the freshers, that nobody had actually ever done their own research about Jesus.
Yeah.
And it's you talked about religion and that Christ wasn't religious. And it struck me, something that Stephen said in this sermon last week, that Christianity is not a religion. Mm. It's actually about a relationship.
That's right.
And I just wonder sometimes whether the whole religion thing gets in the way of people actually thinking, well, there could be something really valuable for me to learn in terms of doing this research.
Yes. You know, when you think about it, I mean, this is right, isn't it? Where this comes from is the fact that Jesus came along and he said, look, I haven't come to get rid of the law. So I've not come to get rid of the rule book. What I've come to do is I've come to keep the whole rule book for you. That's why it's not religion anymore. Because Jesus has actually done everything necessary for you to get to heaven if you put your trust in him. That is a staggering thought. It means you don't have to earn your way in like just about every other faith system in the world will tell you. You've got to do something. Jesus comes along and says, no, I'm not taking away from it. I've done it all. It's a staggering thing, isn't it? I don't think people could come up with that, because we're not wired that way. We are wired to think, if I'm going to get, you know, the pie in the sky, if I'm going to get heaven, I've got to do something for it. That's how we're wired. You don't get anything for nothing. Jesus comes along and his logic is just on another world, isn't it? No, I've done it all for you. Just trust me. I'm your rescuer. You can't do it, actually, but I've done it all for you because I can be perfect for you. It's amazing. Yeah. Good. If no one's got any other questions, that's a good note to leave it on, actually, isn't it? But if you'd like to ask any other questions to anyone in particular, Sibs will take questions later. I'm happy to take questions if you want to talk before you go this morning as well. Francis will as well, I'm sure.